Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at Facebook.com/RadioCafe. Later on in the show, we're going to be talking to composer Brooks Williams, and we're going to be talking about the Metamorphosis Documentation Project. I'm happy now to welcome John Thorndike. He's the author of the book, The Last of His Mind, A Year in the Shadow of Alzheimer's, and he will be at Collected Works Bookstore this Thursday, the 1st of April, at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for calling me.
So this is a memoir of your father at the very end of his life, when he, at a very advanced age, got Alzheimer's disease. I guess he was in his 90s. What was the process by which you made the decision to put your own life on hold and move in with him and really be his primary caretaker?
You know, it goes back to some kind of assumptions you make that are almost under, like an underground river. I somehow always knew that I was going to be looking after my father. I think I had to dig around in my own mind to figure that out later, and it had much to do with my mother dying and my not being around to look after her. I had lots of excuses. You know, I had a 2-year-old son, and I was married to a woman from El Salvador, and I was down there, and one thing and another, but I was very sorry that my mother died in that way, and I think I just assumed always that I would be looking after my dad. And then, much more to the point, was that I had taken him to see an old friend of his in a nursing home down in Connecticut, and I tell the story in the book. And it was a good place, you know, the people were friendly, but the fact was, here was an old friend of his who had lived and died by books. They were both editors at Life and at American Heritage, and here he was living in a little room with a television set and a dresser and a bed and not a single book in there, and my father just couldn't stand it. And so when we got out in the car afterwards, he turned to me and he said, "Don't ever put me in a place like that." And that was enough for me.
Yeah, I mean, that is a very poignant story, because this man is a man who was, the friend, Oliver, was very powerful in his prime. And he was stripped by, I guess, stepsons, by a family that wasn't that close to him or didn't care enough about him. He was stripped of even the books that he himself had written.
Exactly.
It's such a poignant story of the powerlessness of old age.
And my father saw that, and A, he hated it that Oliver was in that state, and B, he did not want to be in that state himself. Now, you know, I was doing a reading the other night, and somebody said, you know, you can go into a nursing home and look around and see 100 people, and probably 95 of them would have said years before, "I am not going to wind up in a place like that." And yet, we do. There are lots of reasons why people get in there, and some very valid reasons. But my father did not want, he wanted to go on living at home. He was very definitive about it.
So unlike the period when your mother was sick, and you were busy and married and lived out of the country and had a 2-year-old and so on, at this time, you were basically relatively free, didn't have any major family ties, your son was grown. And so you moved in with him, and you were warned by a very nice literary Santa Fean whom we know, who we've had on this program, what you were getting into.
Right, that's true. And well, of course, you're warned, but you still don't know in a certain way. And the fact is, you know, my brother, the one I'm closest to, my brother said, you know, what are you going to do? How can you stand? What if he lives for 5 years? And I had no answer to that except to think that I'm going now. And if later I cannot stand it, then we'll see. But I was the one. I had two brothers. One of them had a 2-year-old daughter at the time. And, you know, I'd been through that. And he just couldn't do it. And my other brother was married. They were both married. I was not. And I was just the one who was inclined to do it and wanted to do it. And I may have been a little scared by it, but, you know, just take that jump. And then once you start, it was not so scary in a way.
Now, part of the memoir is about your father himself, who was a very accomplished man and a very interesting man. Tell us about his earlier life as a journalist and an editor.
Well, my dad knew what he wanted to do in life, I think, from an early age. He was born to a couple of people in their 40s. They were quite late. I think he was quite a surprise. He was the light of their life, but they were very hands-off. They were very old New Englanders, very, very reserved, and they just let my father grow up as a single child, which I think was hard on him. But he found his way very early, and in high school he wrote for a couple of the magazines. Then he went to Harvard, and he knew what he wanted to do. He became an editor of the Harvard Crimson, became the managing editor, and from there he went straight in 1934, a difficult year to find jobs. But with a background like that, he got a job with Henry Luce at Time, and then went to work for Time and Life, and he always knew what he wanted to do, and he was very good at it. He was a guy devoted, as I said somewhere in the book, he was as devoted to words as some men are devoted to sports. I mean, words were what he loved. He loved history, and he loved language and literature and the history of the Western Empire, you know. He found what he wanted to do. He went on to found the magazine American Heritage and Horizon, two hardcover magazines, and you know, was quite a successful, quite well-known, was managing editor of Life for a while, and well-known in New York circles, some circles.
And there's a great story in there of his resignation. He was so utterly sure of himself that when people started to mess with him, he just said, "Thank you very much, I'm out of here."
Yeah, he had been arguing a little bit with Henry Luce, and then he had run a story. And it was a little risque. My father was never a risque person. I started to say is not, and that's still what happens sometimes. But he was never like that. He was quite conservative. But, you know, Life, as they said, if they didn't know what else to put on the cover, put a pretty girl on the cover. And so they ran some articles like that, and he'd run an article about some party, and it was kind of lax, and there were some drunken people, and the photos were revealing in ways. And Luce got upset by it later and then tried to make a committee that would have to approve all questionable articles. And my father just couldn't stand this because he said somebody else would be in charge of his decisions and he just wasn't going to accept it. And so that went back and forth. And finally, when Luce pressed him too hard, he just came in. He came into the office on a Friday morning in New York. And he actually was still editing an article. And he went and he finished that job. And then he packed up his briefcase and he asked his secretary to send him everything out to Connecticut. And he said goodbye to two or three people and walked out the door.
It's such a lovely picture that you paint of him, a New Englander who was full of this love of words and neither arrogant nor self-effacing. Very sure of himself, and at the same time, you reflect on how he was for you as a father, and there's a kind of interesting reflection on physical touch and human affection, or the lack thereof, in your life when you were a child and he was a father.
Yeah, I think it's hard to say how he was with me when I was really young, but I think more affectionate, and this is certainly not uncommon with fathers who will hold and embrace their kids, especially their daughters, but it may be the same with sons, up to a certain age, and then there's a parting of the ways, and my father just was not someone who would come up and put his arm around you, whether you were, well, working backwards, 21 or 14 or 7, maybe at 3, but you know, it came a certain point in which he just retreated from that world. He just wasn't comfortable in it. You know, I say in there at one point that my father had learned to bear up under the hugs that came with the 1970s. You know, in the 60s, nobody hugged each other, and not in the world that I was in. And And then come the 70s, and everything is changing around. Everybody's hugging each other, and we go back to see my dad, and my brother hugs him, and I hug him, and our girlfriends or wives hug him, and my father kind of puts up with it. But I think he would have much preferred to just go on shaking hands.
We're talking to John Thorndike. His book is called The Last of His Mind, A Year in the Shadow of Alzheimer's. Now, one thing that I found fascinating was the contrast between your father's way of being and your friend Sandy. Sandy was a proponent of, what is it called, emotional work. And
right.
Your father was very much the opposite. But his response to a manuscript that Sandy had written about emotional work was very balanced, and I thought so fair and interesting.
Yeah, a cogent argument, as I said. Sandy is a friend of mine that I went to school with, and he believes that, you know, to our detriment, that the cathartic expression of emotions has been eliminated or subdued, or that we don't have nearly enough of it. And my father didn't believe in any of it. And yet, those two guys, so different in their orientation, both had the same approach to dealing with what I call coercion of other people. My dad did not believe in telling kids what to do. I mean, ultimately, he wouldn't let me walk out on a busy street, but he wanted to let me decide what to do, and he did that all his life. And Sandy feels exactly the same way. Let the kid decide, or, as you know, the balance to that is when you're dealing with someone who's in his 90s, who's becoming more and more helpless, whose mind is going, you know, how much are you going to tell that person what to do? And people are always telling the elderly what to do. And I can argue this side very well. Why not let them decide? If they want to eat, they should eat. If they want to drink, fine. If they want to go out, let them ask and tell you. That's easy for me to argue, but when I was doing it, it wasn't so easy. I wanted to do things that I knew would help my father feel better that day. It would be easier on him and easier on me, but I had to force him to do it. And I'd gone my whole life without my father forcing me to do things. And so where was I to start with something like that?
Yeah, it brings up questions that almost everybody who deals with elderly parents or relatives or whatever has to address. And putting yourself in the point of view in the shoes of somebody who was so absolutely lucid into his early 90s, I guess, and so profoundly intelligent, and then starting to have to treat them like a child in his shoes, being in his shoes and being treated like a child must have been absolutely horrible during the moments that he was lucid, and those moments came and went during the course of this disease.
Yeah, it's true, and I could see that he did not want that, you know. There's a section in there, you know, where Sandy says, why don't you just let him decide what he wants to do? Why start telling him? And I said, well, sometimes he can't say what he wants. He says, Sandy asked me, doesn't he know what he wants? You can't tell me that he doesn't know what he wants to do. And I said, yes, he wants to be left alone. But then you get someone who's just lost and wasted and is not part of the world, and so much of what we do with the elderly, the old, as they say, is to make sure they're still connected to life, because we think they should be. And who's to say about that? Maybe they don't want to be connected. You know, I went to a reading recently. I did a reading, and there was someone in the audience who said she had a friend who had gone into a nursing home. She had early onset Alzheimer's, and she was devoted to keeping that friend of hers, who had been a good friend all their lives, their adult lives, to keeping her connected to the world. And finally, the woman just says, I don't want any of that. What are you going to say? And that what she wanted was to sit in what looked like a miserable state in her room in this nursing home and do nothing. You know, it's very hard on caretakers to see that, because, you know, I think often we make them do things to make us feel better.
Right. Or to project onto them that if they just did this, can't you see how much better you would feel, which is really how you treat a kindergartner.
And is often the truth. You know, if you would do this, you will feel better. True with a kindergartner and true with a 90-year-old.
Well, is it true with a 90-year-old? Was that your experience?
Well, sometimes, because I describe a scene there in the one afternoon. You know, my father would suffer, as so many of the elderly do, and especially those who are suffering from dementia, from this sundowning, a period in the late afternoon where he would grow blank and lost and confused, and there was something about that time of day, and this is a well-established trait. And instead of letting him do that, occasionally I would urge him to come out. So one day I described this scene in which I urged him, and he said no, and I went back to him again and again, and I basically just pressed him enough until maybe to get rid of me or make me happy or whatever, he said, all right, I'll go. And then we go out and we get in the car and we drive down to the beach. This is on Cape Cod. And he is immediately talkative. The sun actually came out by chance. And we're at the ocean, which he has always loved. And he starts telling stories about the Second World War. And he's engaged. And he's happier. So basically, my forcing him out to do that did make him happier.
That's so interesting. There's some parallels that you write about between your life with your son. You were pretty much a single father, and talking about how you were with your son when he was small, and then how you were with your father when he was old. And one of the things is just that simple experience of spending nonverbal time together.
Yeah, I love that with my son. I mean, with my son, I began to read to him at the age of whatever it was, you know, one or two or something. And I continued that until he was in high school. I used to read to him when he was 14. And then when he was 15, we would lie side by side in his bed and each read our own book. And then by 16, he was reading in his room and I was reading in my room. But, you know, there was a tremendous physical togetherness. Now, with my dad, he was never very comfortable with it, but he kind of had to accept it, both from me and from other caregivers, people who were helping out, in the end, the nurses' aides. People had their hands on my dad, and I have to say that it didn't seem like he was objecting at the end.
Well, it is interesting, too, reading this, that you made some really different choices with your son, that there was lots of physical touch. And the epilogue of the book is about your grandson's birth and the early weeks of his life and the physical affection that he receives from his father, your son,
yeah.
and his mother is just stunning. It's an incredible passage.
Yeah. Yeah, you want your children to do certain things, whether you say you do or not. You know, you would prefer that they would be a certain way. And of course, I wanted my son to be much more like that, much more physically affectionate and open. And he is. And when he comes to have a child, he's just crazy about that boy. Even wilder about him than I was about him, and I was pretty wild about him.
And it did make me think about how one of the big cultural changes that was effected by the 1960s and 70s was this revolution in touch. And who's to say what the long-term effects of that will be? Because it takes a generation or two. But the kids who are being raised now with that amount of touch and affection are so different from their New England counterparts of your father's generation.
I do. No one has ever said this to me about that, but I absolutely agree with you. And sometimes I think about it, yes, what we went through in the 60s, there was a lot of craziness. 60s were mainly in the 70s, but it was a lot of craziness and foolishness and too many drugs and too much looseness, perhaps. A lot of stuff that was not the very best. But we made some big changes. And the one you're describing about the way children are brought up, I mean, what is the salvation of the world? It must be how children are raised. If there's anything that's going to change the world, you'd think it's that. But then I look around and I see, you know, the world is still a pretty mad place, and we're still crazy at war all around the globe. And sometimes I wonder, well, was there an effect? You know, is there a change from that? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. It's very hard to establish any kind of cause and effect with things like that, but your book does give one the opportunity to really reflect on it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it was a vital part of it, and of course it played out as my father got older, and I was taking care of him, you know, cleaning him up and moving him around and, you know, massaging his legs and trying to, you know, keep the circulation going and just everything that you do for someone who is growing more and more helpless, more and more like that younger and younger child.
We're talking to John Thorndike. His book is called The Last of His Mind, A Year in the Shadow of Alzheimer's. Now, another very important part of this book is the reflection on your mother. And your mother died when you were 30. Your parents had already been divorced. And the process of witnessing your father's last month brought up a lot of unanswered questions about your mother and how much you didn't know about her. What was the process like of trying to discover something about her?
Well, I had been working on this for quite some time. The basic history is that my parents were married for 23 years. And how to put this? My father, there were things that my father was not giving my mother. And I kind of always took her side on it to a degree. I mean, she was the bad person in the breakup. She was the one who left my father. But my father could not give her the sex, the romance, the emotion, the connection. He just didn't have that in him. And I think it drove her out. And I always felt a kind of sympathy, I felt an enormous sympathy for my mother and took her side of it to a certain degree, so much so that after she died, I went and visited with the man that she left my father for. She had been with this guy for 4 years, and she left my father, and it promptly fell apart with the other guy, and my mother went into a tailspin for 10 years and then died. But I went to visit him sometime after she died, and then another 20 years went by, and I went to see him again down in Miami both times and asked him, because here was somebody who knew things about my mother that no one else in the world could know or certainly could not tell me. And frankly, I don't put everything in the book that I heard from him, but I put quite a lot. And I was fascinated by that. I was fascinated by my mother's life. Well, when I went to live with my dad, I found a household full of files, papers, pictures, movies, and there was quite a bit of information. I found a note left to my dad by my mother. I mean, things that I would never have discovered if I hadn't gone and lived at my dad's for a year. But in fact, my dad really could not talk about it anymore. He never wanted to anyway, only under duress. He just didn't want to talk about it. And I rather cruelly would drag the topic in front of him because I wanted to know everything about my parents and their life together. Everything. That's just the way I'm made. I don't know what that is. So I found some things about her, you know, from that lover of hers, and I talked to other people, but basically, you know, almost all her friends have died. It's too late now. And I could find out some things, but I could not find out everything.
Well, and it also brings up for the reader, or at least for this reader, all sorts of questions about love and its expression. When somebody files the things that your father filed instead of throwing them away, that's in itself meaningful.
Absolutely. And you would start with the less debatable or less emotionally laden articles, like every painting I ever did, you know, from kindergarten to finger paintings to all the stories that I ever wrote to, you know, my father kept everything. And you're absolutely right. It's an incredible devotion to that. The funny thing was he never went back and looked at anything. I don't know who he was saving it for, if not for me. And I therefore felt free, and I would do it right in front of my dad, to go through all his files and talk to him about what I found, letters to people, letters from his parents, business letters and correspondence and photographs and pictures of a girl he knew in high school, of which there's a very funny story in the book that I cannot repeat on the radio.
Right.
But, you know, I discovered lots of things, all because he saved them. I think you're right. There's an incredible devotion to that, far more than my mother ever had.
Yeah, and there are just so many expressions of love, of devotion, of remembering. And Carlos Castaneda has become kind of a cliche or a pop figure, but this, you have a quotation from him of all paths lead nowhere, but you must choose a path with a heart. And somehow when I look at your father, he so chose a path that had a heart for him, and then saving all that stuff was kind of the hidden side of his life, you know, the Life magazine and all the other stuff being the public side.
Yes, that's right. And you know, I think it's one of the things that I learned and that I could not have learned without going and, you know, leaving my whole life and moving in with him. I didn't know what I was going to find. You know, you just go out, you go on this kind of an adventure. But that was, I think, one of the most important things I learned. It was just a different way of looking at it, to see that my father really had chosen the path with a heart for him, and that the way he was so true to himself. He, you know, he did not want to talk about my mother, and that, you know, he would if I pressed him hard enough, but he was not going to introduce the topic, and he was not going to talk about heartbreak and emotional disturbance. And that's who he was. And he would let me, and for many, many years, let my mother be the way she was. But he didn't want to be that way himself. And there's something I think I never ask more of a person than that they just be completely themselves, that they be true to themselves. It's kind of the highest human calling, is the way I look at that.
And one of the things I loved about your book is it shows that in such a gentle and mutual way, and it shows the process of learning that.
Yeah, because, you know, when I'm the process comes from being locked up with somebody.
Exactly.
Of course, I'm not exactly locked up, but really every day. I mean, I had a couple of breaks during the year. I had two, basically, 10-day breaks. And other than that, I was just on the scene every day. And, you know, it's a tremendous lesson. I mean, I had learned it before. When you're raising, I raised my son on my own after he was 2.5. And when you're doing that, you wouldn't want to show a movie of that to somebody. It would bore them silly. And yet there is something in that which leads to the kinds of connections, to the kinds of love that families have. And if you will not, it's like the little prince. What does the little prince say there? It is the, I can't remember this, but there's a wonderful line that the fox says to the little prince about, it is the things you have wasted, it is the time you have wasted that makes life so beautiful. Or I can't remember
right.
What it is.
Right.
And it is, you need to be able to waste time, to spend yet another evening sitting there saying almost nothing to an old man who can't remember anymore and who's being tortured by it. And yet something grows out of that is bigger than anything else.
You don't hesitate to write about some of the uglier parts of it in terms of having to change soiled sheets over and over again, and the person putting on his underwear over his pants, and all the just incredibly awkward and unhappy manifestations of this disease and of dementia and of old age. And that's part of it too. And the sad part is, I mean, you have to change your baby's diapers, but you know they're going somewhere wonderful, and this is a process headed only toward death.
That is definitely the case. You know, it just occurred to me something that you know, you go in and you have an experience like this. You go and I live it, and I write the book about it. Now the book is set in stone, and I suddenly start to think about it. Oh, yes, this is what happened. The book is what happened. But, of course, the book is not what happened. The book is some kind of distillation. And what I'm thinking now, what I'm remembering is how great it was for me, because I am a writer, how enormous it was for me to go and write everything down. You know, that friend of mine, Lois Gilbert from Santa Fe,
yeah.
She's named in the book many times. You know, she said, you better start writing this down. And I did, and that became a kind of salvation of my sanity, because I could go and change my dad's diapers, and well, I wasn't going to write that over and over and over and over again, but I was led to write something about what it meant or what else was going on or what memory this took me to. Somehow the process of writing it was just, whether I ever published it at all, I mean, I'm a great believer of writing. You know, I'm an old friend of Natalie Goldberg's, and I've been in her classes. You know, you write. This is what we do. You write things down, because it will save your life in some way, and that's the way it was for me.
Did you envision this as a memoir, as a book, or was it more just like, I'm writing this down to get through the day?
Well, when I started, it was the former. I'm writing this down to get, because it was so amazing. Actually, it was so amazing. What was, you know, the amazing part of it was to see my dad's mind disappear. And that was so stunning that I thought, I have got to write down this. And once I started writing that down, I just wrote everything down. And at some point, I began to think, I have a project here. You know, I don't know how long it took me to think a book. It was a long, long way from that set of journals entries, which were just, I mean, if you were to read that, the boredom would be overwhelming, perhaps, because, you know, how many diapers can you talk about changing, or how many
right.
times can you say he couldn't remember this or that, and to go over and over those things. Instead of that, I come into the book, and I start talking about my dad's past, and my mother, and myself, and things out of our family history and whatnot.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's a tricky business to make that stuff interesting to a public that doesn't know you and is never going to probably meet you, unless they go to Collected Works tomorrow night. It's tricky to do that, and you have really done it, because I felt like this book is, it's such an opportunity for reflection for whatever reader is reading it, and everybody who's reading it is going to be at a different stage in their life, and they're going to find something different in it, but it definitely has that kind of appeal for basically anybody who's ever been in a family and thought about love and memory and mortality and illness.
It is an infinite subject. And, you know, when you're writing something, this is the way it is for me, and I'll bet it's this way for Salman Rushdie or any well-known writer. I can't believe they don't go through this, where they'd be writing something and they'll think, who else is going to care about this?
Right.
Why am I spending this time? Ooh. And yet, when the job is well done, then somehow it doesn't matter how small the subject or how large. If someone can take you inside that, into the emotional interior of it, and it will resonate in some way. And this battle you've had with yourself about, you know, is this worthwhile? Do people want to read this? Well, of course, you have to think, there are things that people do not want to read. And then maybe you've written a piece of a book or a whole book, which really got off on the wrong foot, and it will never be a book. I mean, I've written some of those. But when it works out, then you can make that step to just the one you're talking about, to where someone at any age or in any situation can respond to that, because it's close enough to what they know or what they've felt themselves.
Now, it's a truism among caregivers that you can't do something like what you did, live with a person, be the primary caretaker of a person with Alzheimer's or dementia. You can't do it alone. You had the writing, but what else did you have that helped and supported you during this time?
Tennis. That's the first thing that comes to mind. Actually, I had two things. I got to the library almost every day for a couple of hours. a woman came over who had been taking care of my dad before I moved in there. So she knew him well, and she was just, I mean, I know her well to this day. I'll see her next August. I'll always see her. And she's just a fabulous woman. And so she gave me a break there. And then twice a week, I got out and I played tennis. And that just saved my soul, really.
Just that's something, so interesting. You
know, some escape. I mean, to be locked up there, you know, 24/7, there may be saints who could do that, but not me.
Well, I mean, other people would join Alzheimer's support groups or be with other people, but I guess for some people, the physical and sports and just forgetting about it outlet is equally important or more so.
Well, I did, the Alzheimer's Association on Cape Cod was a great help there, and I went to a number of their seminars, but every time I went there, I had to arrange that and get off. You know, because it would come at some other time of day or a dinner, and I would have to get that time off, and it was not easy. So all those things, you know, other people and other groups, I kind of didn't have time for it.
John Thorndike is the author of the book, The Last of His Mind, A Year in the Shadow of Alzheimer's, and he is going to be at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow night, Thursday, the 1st of April, at 6 in the evening. John Thorndike, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
I very much enjoyed it. Now, perhaps I'll meet you tomorrow night.
Excellent. I'm happy now to welcome Brooks Williams. He is a composer and sound designer, and he is in Santa Fe for a fairly short time. He's taking part this coming weekend on the 2nd of April at the Santa Fe Complex Manipulated Image event, and he's performing music and has a video in this event. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thanks.
So talk about your music first, and we're going to be hearing a little bit of that as well.
I've been doing music for a long time, based out of New York. In particular, I was a founding member of a group called History of Unheard Music. We did sort of improvised musics with electronics and acoustic instruments, and also did theatrical performances.
What was the theater component of it?
Well, we had what we call a station, where it would be a mixer, sound devices. Also, we did action painting. We may have a movie projector or a slide projector, puppets, masks. So it was sort of rock and roll theater in a way. I mean, only in the spirit of rock and roll. The music itself was sort of all over the map stylistically, I think, but always with sort of a bit of humor in it also.
When you talk about the experimental music scene in New York, that encompasses almost everything. What were you in particular experimenting with?
Well, I've always had an affinity for electronic instruments and synthesizers, and then that evolved into computers. And then also experimenting with styles of music and ways of performing music.
So what will you be doing this weekend and with whom?
Well, this weekend I will be performing by myself. It'll be a short performance in that the show is mainly a video series called Manipulated Images.
Right.
And so I started getting interested in doing videos and photography over the last 10 years or so. And it fits in well with what I do with music because it involves computers. Manipulating images is not that far in some ways from manipulating sound.
Is that right?
Well, yeah, I find an affinity for it. Technically, there are things that are different, but yeah, to me, I have an affinity for that type of...
I suppose the more time goes on, the more people are doing similar things on their computers.
Well, the tools are just amazing. And of course, when you say similar, sometimes the tools produce certain results easily, and people can do that.
Well, you've got a sound file or you've got a video file, and you can manipulate them in incredible software ways.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then when I first got in started with electronic music, I didn't envision to the levels that it would get to, and as affordable and powerful as it's gotten to today. It's been really great.
You've had a group for some time. You founded the group called History of Unheard Music. Unheard Music, okay, oxymoron of the day. What does that mean?
Well, it actually came out of a performance. it was just the idea of looking at certain points of history and trying to imagine the soundtrack for that. And then that just became our name. Catherine the Great, or Attila the Hun on attacks, and after the aftermath of his attack, and I don't know. These were our images that we would conjure.
And so then you would think, what was the soundscape going on when Attila the Hun was doing his thing?
And that's what it was. But that was a performance, and that was the theme of a performance. And then we needed the name, and so that just became our name, The History of Unheard Music, or HUM, which we liked.
So you're taking part in the Manipulated Image series at Santa Fe Complex this week, and not just you.
In fact, there's going to be some other artists at this event from Colorado. I don't know them, but Lale Mehran and Chris Coleman, also from Colorado.
Right.
So that should be of interest, that people, they'll be talking about their work.
You live in New York. How has the experimental music scene evolved in the, 20-plus years that you've been working in it?
Well, now it's on to, new generation. And I think that's of interest to me, seeing the children of improvisers of 20, 30 years ago adapting and digesting and coming up with new forms of experimental music.
Are they using different tools?
Well, they're using, in some ways, yes. When I was first starting off, there were computers weren't used. You know, we had synthesizers, samplers weren't used. We were doing things with very crude instruments. So these tools have gotten very powerful. And I think they've digested these styles, you know, along with pop music and all the other styles. And it's fascinating to see how it keeps evolving, and people are accepting experimental conventions that are now, you know, people are used to it. So it's no longer startling.
Right.
And
When something is no longer startling and shocking, then you can use it and go further with it.
Sure. I mean, not everything has to be startling and shocking. You know, I enjoy all kinds of things, and things of beauty or different meanings. But it's great that the language has gotten more sophisticated.
Brooks Williams is a composer and sound designer, and we're going to go out with a piece from one of his discs from The History of Unheard Music. Thanks so much for being here, and we'll see you at the Santa Fe Complex.
Great. Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome Craig Johnson and Armando Espinosa Prieto. They are with the Metamorphosis Documentation Project. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Welcome, Mary Charlotte. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. I'm glad to be here.
So this is a project which we have been following on this program over the years. You have documented a very interesting event that is taking place in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Yes, I think since the last time we were here, we've actually finished that project, which was the La Danza de la Pluma, the feather dance.
And you brought them to Santa Fe.
The very final phase after presenting it at the Art Institute, Santa Fe Art Institute here, was this last summer, we brought the dance group itself up to New Mexico for four presentations, two here in Santa Fe, one at the National Hispanic Cultural Center in Albuquerque, and one down in Socorro at the International Heritage Center.
And so what was the motivation for the project in the first place, and where is it? What is it metamorphosing into now?
Well, when we first started, we just wanted to do a documentation of this specific dance and do such of a project with the community, so it wouldn't be just us documenting, but it would be like community service at the same time. So we come full circle after finishing all that and bringing the dancers. And then because of the way people have talked to us when the dancers were here, every time we presented the film, we decided to try to expand it and bring people to Oaxaca as a tour, as a fundraiser for future projects.
Yep. Since this project, which we had the good fortune to be at the Santa Fe Art Institute acting as a fiscal agent for the Danza de la Pluma project, we now have obtained nonprofit status on our own, so that Metamorphosis Documentation Project is a 501c3. And we will be moving on to further large projects, but in the meantime, we're expanding on that one where we already have the contacts in the community and know people well and people know us well, so that we felt that we could take a small group of people down for an intimate tour where we ourselves will be the two people that will be managing and guiding the tour and visiting artists, artisans, museums, and then finishing it all off with a long weekend right in Teotitlan del Valle, where we documented the Danza de la Pluma, where they'll be celebrating a feast day of the Virgin of the Rosary over 3 days with all of the attendant celebration and ritual that goes with it, including a presentation of the Danza de la Pluma.
Now, this is something that people can actually go with you to see to Mexico. I mean, that's the point of this tour, this event.
Exactly. We'll be leaving here the 22nd of September, and we'll be staying initially in the city of Oaxaca in a nice bed and breakfast. We'll be going side trips to visit artists in their studios. We have about 15 artists and artisans lined up, some of them that have exhibited previously here in Santa Fe and are well known there and in all different disciplines, but that we know personally, and we'll be visiting them in their studios. And then we'll also have a couple of the museums, the large museums in
Oaxaca. Like five markets.
And local regional markets. And we'll be with them all the time. There'll be, like I say, only 10 people and the two of us. And finishing it all off in Teotitlan del Valle.
And with, you know, we have very good connections in Teotitlan. I mean, we're very well liked. We know everybody. We know the museum.
Right.
We are allowed into the houses. We're fed. So it'll be a very unique type of experience for people that come with us, because they'll have this insight they could never have of the culture that they could never have if they
right.
went by themselves.
Yeah, it's not something you can do as a tourist, because you've paved the way with years and years of not only documentation work, but as you say, public service and getting to know people and all of that. Now, one thing I was thinking about is nobody wants to go to Mexico these days because it's so dangerous. Is that...
That's really not the case in Oaxaca for tourism. Back in 2006, there was an element of that that's not related to the drug violence that's happening in parts of Mexico now, where there's a large teacher strike, and there was a time when people didn't want to go. There were government warnings, and actually there was not much danger even at that time. We were there during the strike for different reasons, and although it was quite impressive what was happening, we were not in any danger at any time. But that has passed completely, and Oaxaca has not been experiencing anything like the levels of violence that you're hearing or that is happening along the border.
Well, it's not only on the border. I mean, it's all over the place. Where was the Monterrey?
In Monterrey, yes, but that is up towards the border. That's like the largest city that's up in the northeast quadrant. That's you know why it in particular. In most other places, because most drugs, or a lot of them, do come through overland, but it's just overland things. And that's Oaxaca, it's known that there's quite a few drug shipments that come through, but it's just a strictly transshipment point, so that there's not that level.
But even you know, we've driven to Oaxaca for the last 3.5 years, sometimes a few times, and we've never encountered
from Santa Fe.
From
yes.
Santa Fe, and we've never encountered, you know, going through the borders. We really, you know, it's I know it's a gamble, but
including this last December, we drove back and forth, and we do plan to this time also. When we go down for the tour, we will be driving ahead of time, and we have, you know, plane fare is included, so that people will be coming as a group. But we will meet them there at the airport, and we'll have driven down earlier to get the final preparations and everything, make sure everything's smooth. And we'll be driving back also.
But no, so it's not that dangerous.
So it's in September, and if people want to find out more, they can call here in the area code 505, they can call 984-3295. They can also go to metamorphosisdp.org, and metamorphosis is spelled in the Spanish way, metamorphosisdp.org. Craig Johnson and Armando Espinosa Prieto are the directors of the Metamorphosis Documentation Project, and unfortunately it's time to go, but thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.